Okay, I'm excited to introduce Harry Ranson on another episode of the Man V Life Radio podcast today. Harry's someone I've known for quite a long time, and I'll actually tell you the story of how we met later on, but yeah, I'm really excited to have him here because I feel he's got the whole balance of nutrition right, and there's lots of things I want to talk to him about, so thank you for coming on the show, Harry.
No, thank you very much for having me on.
Cool. So, with your... I want to start with nutrition with you purely because that's what you're known for. You're known as like a healthy chef or a fit chef, but I don't want to call you that because people might think I like you too much. So the thing is, you kind of, to someone who is getting into healthy eating, they could misconstrue what you say, I suppose, as like, oh, you can eat anything, right? Because you have a very balanced life. But What is your take on nutrition, and can you explain to the guys how you have found balance in what you do?
Okay, so when basically I first started out in the fitness industry, started going to the gym like, you know, a lot of guys when I was a teenager, and I was, all the information out there on the internet was typically chicken, broccoli and rice. I know it sounds cliche, but it was, and you know, after a few years, you're allowed to eat salmon as well and avocados and stuff like that. It started to get a little bit more flexible. But I started working with a coach for one of my first show. It was actually my second show in like 2012. And it was a bit of an eye-opener for me because what he said was, he said, well, okay, we just need to kind of fit these macronutrient targets, you know, your protein, carbs and fats. And I thought it was a bit mental, to be honest. But it was real eye-opener for me because I actually got in a better condition doing that than I did having followed, you know, the whole kind of clean eating kind of thing. And I kind of went on this, I don't really know how to explain it, but I was obviously a big advocate of it. Like anyone that follows a diet and gets results, they become an advocate of that diet.
Yeah, okay.
If you get results doing paleo, like, you will shout paleo. And I kind of started shouting about this, if it fits your macros thing, you can eat whatever you want, provided it fits your macros. And I was young then. And what I've kind of learned, you know, kind of, as I get older and wiser, as we were kind of speaking about earlier, is that it's understanding the core principles of why it is working and how, again, you can incorporate in that into a daily life. So I realised that the calories, protein, carbohydrates, fat were key to body composition, but you've also got to take into account the overall diet and the composition of the diet in terms of the foods you're eating. So where I kind of went from clean eating to if it fits your macros, as it were, as I got older, I thought, right, okay, how can we do both? How can we combine the two effectively? But whilst also fitting in with your everyday person, okay, because, you know, it's quite common at the time, a couple of years ago, people to be doing 8-12 week diets, they get fantastic results, and then they just go, you'd see about 3 weeks worth of cheat meals and all that. So I was kind of like, right, okay, how can we mitigate this? So yeah, that's kind of where it all came from. I started doing kind of recipes, but all the nutritional information would be there, and it's kind of just educating people that, you know, you can swap foods around and still get goals. There's no magic foods,
basically. Of course. I've definitely seen that progress, and I think the key you hit on there, I remember doing my first ever 12-week transformation, and I was in the shape of my life, and I remember I was going swimming with my nephew. I was only 21 and I'd never looked this good, and I was going to swim with him 3 days after I'd done the end shoot, and I was so excited because I was like, I'm going to look really good. I was a water balloon because I just pigged out. I was just so out of shape, and I was kind of sat there bemused, like, what's happened? Like, I put all this work in to look like this, and I looked, you know, just a mess. So I think that's really important, that I think a good rule is, how does someone look 12 weeks after the end of a transformation?
Yeah, 100%.
You know, like 3 months in. So going back to your kind of approach to nutrition, I know you're quite analytical about the way you track things, right?
Yes.
How do you cope with clients who, so like me, I'd be a nightmare for you because I'm pretty familiar with, you know, good nutrition, and I get all that, but I hate with a passion weighing all my food. I am doing so now because I've decided this year I really need to step up I'm coasting, I'm doing okay, but I can do better. And I suppose turning 27 this week's frightened me a bit. So like I wanted to I just thought come on, like, you can do better. But if someone's like, yeah, I'm cool with eating well, but I don't necessarily want to have to wait every meal out, how do you address clients like that, or do you not?
Yeah, no, I would. So, funny enough, I'm actually going to be posting some of this stuff on my Facebook and Instagram, so make sure you go follow me.
Mm-hmm.
Shameless plug.
Yeah.
No, I think you've got to align your expectations with the amount of sacrifice and effort you're willing to put in.
Mm.
So I kind of typically work off maybe four different types of ways of kind of dieting or, you know, following a nutrition. So, you know, the first way would be just changing your habits and, again, eating like healthy, okay? So that would be, I guess, the initial, the bottom of the pillar. But ultimately, like you said, if you do that, that works well for, like, maintenance and coasting and things like that. And then moving on from that, you can look at kind of looking at your total calorie intake and just tracking your calorie intake and making sure, again, that you're eating plenty of protein and carbs and fats and just getting a decent balance.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be kind of step three. Step two would be protein and calories.
Yeah.
So again, making sure you're getting in enough protein and enough calories for whatever your goal is. And then step one, or the kind of the top of the pillar, or top of the pyramid, would be counting all of your macros.
Yeah.
So there's kind of pros and cons to every single one of those. And I think the level that you want to achieve is basically going to dictate which kind of pillar you go towards.
Makes sense.
So if you are contest prepping, I would just say you've got to count your macros. You've got to do it. But you know, if you wanted to maintain and coast, then don't track and just kind of follow the habits that you learned from previously tracking. Like, I think everyone needs to track their food for some period of time, just because the amount of times that I've got a client tracking food and they're like, wow, I didn't know how much that had that much in it or whatever. Yeah. Like, I just think it's a fantastic learning tool, but I also don't necessarily believe you need to be tracking every single day of your life down to the gram. I just think it's almost like a sliding scale.
Yep.
Depending on what your goal is, really.
That's very relevant. Just the other night, Sophie and I were having dinner, and because I just had taken more control of my diet, and like, my diet is like 80% good. It's really not okay. And I don't mean like clean and bad foods. I mean, it's like, it's pretty on point. It's just, like you said, the stuff you're not accounting for in your head. And we were going to have, we just had a chicken and rice meal, it was, but it wasn't just chicken and rice. I had broccoli as well. And but basically, we had a dressing and there was sweet corn as well, which I'd usually just chuck on there. And I just, out of curiosity, looked at what the calories were. And that would have, the half a tin plus the tablespoon of dressing would give an extra 130 calories. Now, that's not mental or detrimental, but over a week, that's actually quite a lot of extra calories, isn't it? That's what, like 30 minutes on the treadmill, possibly 25 minutes of, you know, walking, roughly. So like, I think it's not a case of being scared of that, is it? It's just being mindful, milk in your coffee, things like that. People don't even think about it. They might have like a latte twice a day. That could, I don't know, that could be 300, you know, 400 calories. And it's like, over a week, it's quite a lot, isn't it? So, how do you then, how can I say, do you find that structuring diet is like finding what people like and then giving them a formula each day to follow, meaning rather than just having macros to hit, because that can be obviously hugely time consuming doing every single meal if you've never had that meal before. So it's like, right, there's 10 meals you really love, mix and match. Is that the kind of thing you do, or do people just go like, eat whatever they want every day as long as they're tracking it?
Yeah, so the way that I tend to coach my clients is I would typically send them like some sort of a questionnaire, and I'll ask them, you know, how do you eat currently?
Yeah.
And what do you like to eat? So that, because ultimately one of the key things to dieting and being successful is adherence.
Mm.
You know, it doesn't matter how good a plan is if you can't stick to it.
Yeah.
So I will first ask them, you know, what is your current eating pattern look like? And that, again, that works around their, you know, their job, maybe they've got kids or whatever their lifestyle is, and also what do you like to eat. And then typically I would write them a meal plan based on the macros I think for them and their current daily structure, because you kind of want to change as few of things as possible for people.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just a case of taking what they're already doing but organizing it a little bit more sensibly.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what I would say. And for a lot of people, actually, I tell them if they're going to be tracking and things like that, a lot of the time, just to give them a bit of structure, I tell them to try and track as much as they can the day before.
Yeah.
So then, you know, they can prepare their meals the night before. They don't need to stress about what they're eating the next day. And they don't get to the end of the day and think, oh, I've got 50 grams of protein left and it's, you know, 10 to 12. What do I do?
Yeah. Like, yeah. No, that makes sense.
Yeah. You've definitely got to give people structure. And that's something that I was, you know, the fault of my coaching before. It's like, okay, here are your macros, go and track.
Yeah.
Whereas now I give people training on how to do it, how to structure their days, and things like that, and just give them a little bit more of a nudge in the right direction. But yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, for sure. Do you have any kind of preferences on how regularly people eat in the day, provide they hit the numbers, or do you really not care?
So, in terms of like macro distribution, there I do have a few things. I think it's just based on the more recent evidence, and it's funny because it's good to kind of say that you're wrong or admit that you are wrong or that's not correct. Like before, I would kind of say, yeah, total protein intake. And I do think that is still definitely the key in terms of hitting your total protein intake for the day. Because, you know, you see people that do intermittent fasting and they get fantastic results. So you can't deny that. But I think based on the research now, we're seeing more and more in, you know, that supports regular protein.
Yeah.
So the bodybuilders of old school, you know, they were right. Basically, you know, get a good 30, 40 grams of protein every 3 to 4 hours, particularly around training as well. And then carbohydrates typically, again, around training, like before training and after training, I think you need those carbohydrates to fuel your training and obviously to replenish afterwards.
Yeah.
But yeah, typically that's kind of what I give people. But again, I always ask them as well. I say, you know, when are you hungriest? You know, if you're like absolutely starving in the evening, then try and backload a lot of your food, whether that be carbs, proteins, fats, towards the end of the day. Because again, the longer you can stick to a diet or to a nutrition, the better results you're going to get.
Of course. I think it's quite interesting. I've kind of done a blend of what you're saying now. So I've got someone doing my diet. And I'm really happy eating, genuinely happy eating the same thing all day. So like in the mornings, lunch, pre-gym, 3 or 4 meals, I'm happy if those 4 meals or 3 meals remain the same all week. It doesn't bother me. I'm more happy. The one I kind of want the flexibility in is my evening meal with Soph, where it's a more sociable meal, isn't it? As where during the day, I'm just like eating on the go. So that's where I have, when I say flexibility, I don't mean it needs to have like chocolate cake or anything all the time.
But yeah,
like,
yeah.
I don't know what I want tonight. I want a few options. So that's kind of how I've based mine. And we're actually using a lot of your recipes, which we'll get onto later. So basically you can eat more by controlling the calories, because you can reduce calories, so you can eat more of it rather than a small meal that's hugely calorie dense, right? And that's for me a big thing. So I think evening is where like 80% of people fall apart with their overconsumption. Yes. They're bored or they're sat in front of the TV, more hungry, especially this time of year when it's cold, you know, it's like comforting. So I agree with that. So with your recipes, that's probably your USP as a coach, I suppose. You're really well known for it, have been for a long time. You work with Iceland and companies like that, right?
Yeah, so been doing some business in Iceland and muscle food and stuff like that. So yeah, I've been doing a few things.
Awesome. So do you want to explain how you, obviously you can't, like it's not a system, I understand that, but like what inspired you to come up with that, and how do you keep coming up with these recipes which are so like good but are low in calories?
I'll pay you later. Okay, so do you know what, it was my second contest prep. So I did two competitions in 2012. One that I did, the first one I did was again like similar to what you said, where you eat pretty much the same every day. And just to touch on that for a second, I think my most successful clients, they do very similar. Same breakfast, same lunches throughout the week, same snacks, and it's only their dinner that changes, and that's where you get that variety. And I think that reduces the margin of error. So I would actually highly recommend it. Yeah. Make it the like breakfast that you enjoy, lunches you enjoy, snacks you enjoy, and then just change dinner.
It cuts down on the stress as well, right? Because I find it stressful if I have to tracking my evening meal. Like, say if I pick 10 of your recipes and I'm like, right, any one of those will fit if I've just got to adjust a few things, that's cool. But if I had to like do that on every meal every day because I was changing it, then that would become a little bit overwhelming.
Exactly. So I think that is definitely like a key to a lot of the more successful. But I'm exactly the same. I eat the same breakfast every day, pretty much the same lunch, same snacks, and just a different dinner. But that was kind of the way I did my first comp, and I did well. But then the second comp, obviously, I was given this flexibility and freedom, and I was like, okay, so I have these macronutrient targets to hit on a daily basis. Now I need to, you know, make it stuff that I enjoy eating. So as with anyone on a diet, whether you're doing it flexibly or you're doing it clean or paleo or whatever, you typically tend to get a little bit more food focused.
Yeah,
like that's just a side effect of dieting. So I kind of got into this idea that, okay, so I can pretty much eat whatever I want. I still want to make the like healthy food, but I just want to make it more interesting.
Yeah.
So I found that I had spare time, and I was thought, well, I just want to make some cool food. And actually the kind of that whole fake away concept where you're kind of taking those comfort foods or the foods that you have on a takeaway that I knew that I couldn't have because it didn't matter how many macros I was on. There's no way I was fitting in a chicken tikka masala in my diet.
Yeah.
So no one's got the facts for that. So yeah, I just started making these kind of like fake away recipes, and I just started posting them, and I had like the worst website in the world. I think I had done for like £300. It looked like a 3-year-old had made it, and I just started posting them, and people just became really receptive to it.
Yeah.
And I have this weird thing with cooking, whereas when I'm cooking, it's almost like my therapy, like my meditation. Like I just zone out.
Yeah.
So I think that it was kind of a combination of, I know this is going to help clients, I know this is going to help give value to other people, but I also just enjoy doing it.
Yeah.
And I zone out when I do it, I just enjoy doing it. And then I just thought, well, do you know what? I might as well take a picture of it and post it on the internet like everyone else.
Yeah. That's really cool. It's very interesting because especially when you started doing it, it was far more unique than like a lot. It's more like the accepted thing now. But I think I got to know you and I was at Monster Supplements, so I was 21.
Yeah.
And, 21. And you won a competition to meet Rob Richards through Monster Supplements, didn't you? Do you remember? And that's how I got to know you because I saw you post below saying you lived in Hayward Heath, which is close to where my sister lives. And I was like, oh, cool. We'll have to go and train. And that's how I got to know you. But yeah, it's interesting how it's far more accepted now to do this kind of thing, your nutrition. And I think it's really cool because it's like it removes the stigma of the fitness lifestyle, doesn't it? That you don't have to be so boring about it. And I also think it's cool that you still have the focus of the nutrients there, because I think people have gone too much the other way. What I see now, what was like the big if it fits your macros thing through a few years ago, and IF has had its time, kind of the paleo poliquin approach has had its time. I think the big thing at the minute is lifestyle, which I agree with, but I think people kind of get it wrong. It's almost like I want a pizza, right, I'm gonna have one because it's lifestyle, and it's like but there needs to be some like times where you say no, like you can't just say that every time. And I think people have almost gone too far with that to an extent where it's nothing to do with the food being the issue. It's just overconsumption of calories because people have gone so aggressive with this whole life's too short and all, which I totally am cool with and I understand. But I think people do have to remember it's like you do, if you want to get in good shape, you do have to keep on top of your numbers to an extent, don't you?
Yeah, I think that you need to, I don't know if sacrifice is the right word or compromise, but you can't literally have your cake and eat.
Yeah.
Like, there's got to be a time where you've got to understand that. There's a great quote that I always hear is that even if you don't count calories, your body does, or something like that. I probably butchered that quote, but it's true. It's like, you know, you can completely disregard them and pretend that they're not there, but the true fact is that if you overconsume food, then you're gonna put on fat, and or you're gonna not lose it. So
how do you just because you have a lot of experience in coaching people, you've gone quite far with your coaching. Well, very far. You've had Bollywood actors go in front of Men's Health magazine and Men's Fitness, movies, that kind of thing. So what kind of things do you do in terms of clients when they have cravings for things? Do you kind of go through the diet and go, right, can I address this with more fiber or maybe fats in certain places, or do you try and give them recipes? What's the solution if they're all saying, Harry, this time of day, I am like hungry, I'm craving, or do you just say, shut up, wind gym?
I let them have it. Honestly, no, so either I will try and find a light recipe. So one of the things that I've never actually posted it, but one of the things that I always think whenever I'm creating a recipe is, can we create 90% of the flavor for 50% of the calories?
Okay.
Obviously, it's not going to exactly work that way, but you know, healthier food or healthier versions of food, they're not going to taste exactly the same, but can we try and get like a disproportionate amount of taste for the calories?
Yeah.
So that's always like kind of my first thought of call. If not, if someone is really craving something, I will typically just say, okay, we can do that, but we're going to have to take from elsewhere.
Yeah.
And I think that the way I explain it to a lot of clients now is to think of it almost like a monetary budget. Okay. So let's say you had a certain amount to spend per week.
Yeah.
Okay. You're going to have to scrimp for 5 days of the week or 6 days of the week if you want to splurge on one day of the week and stuff like that. But what I'd like to do more than anything is make the client understand. And rather than just saying, okay, well, we need to reduce here, I'll just say, look, these are your options. You can eat, you can have that, but that means we're going to have to pull calories and typically carbs and fats, because that's usually what they're craving. We're going to have to pull them from these days in order for you to have it on this day and give them the option. And that kind of serves two purposes. One, it teaches them what to do and how it works.
Yeah.
But it also puts them in control of the decision as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Which empowers them a lot more. So if, you know, they're making that decision at the end of the day, so that they can't have a pop at me saying, oh, Harry, I'm hungry. I'll be like, well, you made this decision. I just gave you the options. Like, you didn't have to go for it, but if you really, really want that pizza at the weekend, then we're going to have to pull carbs and fats throughout the week to build a buffer. You know, you're almost saving money. You're just saving calories.
Do you ever get them to exercise more to create that deficit? Would you encourage that? So like if someone said on Saturday, hey, it's my birthday Thursday. If I was your client, right, I'm going to have this massive pizza. I'm having it. It's 3,000 calories. But I said I'm willing to do an hour and a half of cardio a day to make up for that. Would you encourage that, or is that not? That doesn't sound like a good relationship to me.
No, I think a lot of the time it depends on the client and their background.
Yeah.
You know, if they have a background of some sort of eating disorder, then 100% no.
Yeah.
But typically on a day like that, I would probably just pull back on the food intake, because I think it's easy for them to see that, you know, I used to give my clients, so I still do give them like daily macronutrient targets, but I've now kind of extended that into like a weekly macronutrient target, again, to fit in with the lifestyle. So I say, okay, this is what I recommend daily, but if you overshoot your calories one day, don't panic. You can just gradually bring them down throughout the week and hit those weekly targets at the end. So I typically just tend to do just 3 calories. But what I will say is make sure on the day that you're going to be having your, you know, pizza or whatever, make sure you train really hard. Make sure you go and train. If you do have any cardio to do that week, make sure you get your fitting it all in. Because as you know, that makes you more insulin sensitive. Yeah. You're effectively, burning through glycogen and carbohydrates, which you're going to be filling up pretty soon after. So
itself a bit more of a sponge kind of thing, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. So I definitely wouldn't encourage that, because I don't want people to get into that kind of binge purge cycle where they overeat and then the next day they're up at the crack of dawn smashing out cardio.
Yeah.
I mean, it would work. It's then my dynamics at the end of the day, that would work, but you just don't want to get into that kind of cycle.
No, like I've seen people in the past, they'll have like a chocolate bar waiting for post-cardio, and it's like, it doesn't work, does it, in your head? It doesn't kind of like fit that you're putting yourself, it's torturing yourself for some chocolate, really. That's just going to really cripple your your approach to food, isn't it, and your relationship with food. Okay, that's interesting. Do you get your clients doing much cardio of interest? Are you? I know it's a variable, and not everyone's the same. But do you do that, or and do you track the calories they burn on like technology with Fitbits and stuff, or not?
Yeah, I tend to. Again, I kind of offer it up. I just say again, I like to teach my clients, empower my clients, and let them understand, you know, where calories come from, how we burn calories, and I kind of give them the option, and it's kind of like a little triangle of things. Okay, so you've obviously got the calories you eat.
Mm.
The calories you burn on a daily basis through walking, and then the calories you burn in the gym and doing cardio. And I just kind of give them the option. I say, look, you know, you can do more cardio and eat more food if you want, to a point, obviously. Like, yeah. You know, they get to a point where doing too much cardio starts to interfere with your training and just general life.
Yeah.
Or you could make a more conscious effort to do more steps. I think there's this whole being more conscious of getting out and walking more is definitely a positive.
Yeah.
So again, if you didn't want to do many steps a day, say you were like, you know, some days I find that I do like 4,000 steps a day because I'm just, you know, I'm stuck on my laptop, I haven't done anything. In which case I would say, right, you probably need to do more cardio.
Yeah.
To make up for it. Or, you know, you could eat less food and do less cardio. It's kind of it is a bit of a sliding scale. Like, where you change one is going to directly affect the others.
Of course.
But I do like the majority of my clients to do some cardio, purely for the cardiovascular benefits. And I typically give them a calorie target. So I'll say, you know, 400 calories a week, 600, 800 or whatever. And I'll just say, you know, do the cardio you enjoy. Use a Fitbit. Use the machine. Again, they're not going to be hugely accurate, but as long as you're consistent with it,
yeah,
it doesn't really matter too much.
Because,
you know,
it's all relative.
Yeah, it's all relative. So if I say, okay, we need to increase your cardio by 200 calories per week, like, it's going to be, they're going to end up doing more cardio.
Yeah.
So it is relative. So that's typically how it works, but it's not necessarily a set kind of, again, I'll just offer them the option. I'll say, look, if you want to sack the cardio off, that's fine, but you're probably going to need to eat less food.
Mm. So when you go into your breaking your macros down, I know that you're well, it's not that you're pro carbs, it's just that you're not anti carbs. Like you're not like worried of carbs. What if a client says to you like, I'm actually one of these people, I probably prefer, if I had to write a list of foods I would miss more, the kind of carbs I like are generally like shit carbs, or, you know, like cake, Welsh cakes, chocolate, that kind of thing. I wouldn't really miss it if you said, oh, you can't eat much rice. I'd be like, oh, okay. I'll have a bit. I don't need to eat that all day. But I would miss things like almond butter, eggs, red meat, salmon. I enjoy that kind of stuff. So do you base your nutrition breakdown on what the client enjoys, finds palatable, and if they say, I feel much better on a more fat-dense diet rather than carbs and vice versa?
Yeah, 100%. I think I was maybe, again, in the past, I would probably do it on my own bias.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like what I prefer, what I found works for me, and I would almost force that on the client. Whereas now, again, it seems, it's funny, because when I say it out loud and all these things, it seems like I don't do anything when I do my talk. So I want to empower the client and make sure that they are 100% happy with it, because the last thing I want for a client to say is, I'm not enjoying my food, I'm not enjoying my training, I feel like crap and stuff like that. Whereas actually, you know, I want to make sure that they are set up to succeed, basically. So typically I will say, do you prefer carbohydrates or fats? And I will still include both, but the ratios and the amounts may just change a little bit.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I will always say, again, when we're making adjustments, shall we reduce carbs or fats? Protein typically stays the same. Sometimes it will increase, sometimes it will decrease, but not a huge amount. Typically, it's carbs and fats we're changing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I will always ask them, I say, you know, what do you prefer? And I will always give them the consequences of either one. So I'll typically say, if you drop your carbs too low, you may find your performance suffers in the gym.
Mm.
And things like that. So I will always offer it up to them. I will always make sure that I have a good amount of both.
Sorry. Bloody phone. I can't turn this one off. I can't turn my mobile off. Okay, so now that makes sense. What do you do with, I find, especially in the Man V Life community, right, a lot of guys say that they struggle with fiber because it's not fun. Like, who enjoys eating? It's not like, oh, I fancy some broccoli or, you know, so like, it's not that they maybe dislike it, you just never think of it. And if I'm on a road trip in the car, I will always go, right, I've got my, you know, grab some chicken from Waitrose or whatever, rice cakes, nuts, that kind of thing. But you're not really ever, right, I'm going to grab a salad and eat in the car, are you?
No.
How do you address it if someone is particularly bad at eating their fibre? Or again, is it a case of going, well, you have to sort this out yourself? Or...
Yeah, this is a real struggle. This is a real struggle with a lot of people. Again, it's I think that it's about educating people on what foods contain fibre, and it's about trying to differentiate which fibre sources are readily available as well, like easy to pick up and things like that.
Yeah.
I think it's also worth looking at it in context. So, for example, if someone is only away for one day, I wouldn't really worry about it. Like, if their fibre was like 15 grams for that day. If every other day is fine, I wouldn't really worry about it. Whereas if they were away regularly, I would, you know, I would knuckle down and say, right, okay, what are the sources that we know that we can definitely be having?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the sources you enjoy as well? So it's like, okay, here's a list of foods that contain a decent amount of fibre. Let's pick five or six of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another one is some people just hate those foods with fibre. So I think, right, how can we make them eat it without them, you know, with the least kind of resistance?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's making a smoothie that tastes rubbish.
Yeah.
But it gets it out of the way.
Yeah.
You know, typically I'd recommend, like, trying to spread your fibre for obvious reasons, but sometimes it's like, okay, some people just hate fruit and vegetables or whatever. Let's just bang it in a smoothie, and maybe even if you spread that out two or three times throughout the day, just neck it and follow it up with something else.
Yeah.
That would obviously be at the extreme end.
Yeah.
But I'd always just make people aware and try and give them advice on if they were out and about what they can pick from. But like you said, if it's just for one day that you're away, like, I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah. So what do you do in terms of, well, I say what do you do with training, taking the male population, how many times do you think men need to train per week to get lean? And I know, again, that's it depends on lots of variables, but what you like, you really need to be training a minimum of, because I've been situations in my life when I was younger where I could train, there was a time when I could train twice a day, nearly six, seven times a week, which is not realistic for me now. So I'll train about five times, then I'll do cardio outside. For you, what's like the minimum? And what's the optimal, in your opinion?
Well, I would say the minimum is three times a week. I think that any less than three times a week. I would probably say the best is probably about five. Most of my clients that I have with me train four or five times a week. And they're the ones that typically get the best results. Like you said, it kind of comes down to the context, like how long are you training for, what else are you doing outside of the gym and things like that. But I know, you know, people like, you know, very definitive answers. So I would definitely say like three to five. And obviously the amount you eat is going to depend on how many times you're training as well.
Yeah.
Obviously if you're not training, you're not very active, you're only training three times a week, it's going to affect how many calories you can eat.
Yeah.
And that may affect how lean you get. You know, training more often to a degree just allows you to burn through more calories, and it's a little bit easier to get lean, basically.
Yeah, I remember when I, at that time when I was training that frequently, every day, sometimes twice a day, my diet is probably the least clean per se then. I was eating all my protein, etc., but I was having a joke with one of my friends, and basically every time I'd hit a PB on a squat, I'd have three Yorkies after I trained. It was like, 'cause I loved them. But I was lean, but it was literally because I couldn't eat enough. I was training so much. It was like, there comes a point when you're training that frequently, you can't just get all your calories through like rice and that, can you? Because the amount you'd have to eat is ridiculous. So it was interesting. It was actually quite interesting. I would love to do that all the time, but I just don't have the time. Sophie wouldn't appreciate it. But okay, so with your clients, when you're working out, what you talk about, macros, calories, etc., do you base that all on their weight, or do you have like an estimation of, in your head from experience, right, he will need X amount, or how do you work it out? Or is it trial and error? Because I think a lot of people...
Do you know what? If I'm being honest, when you first start with a client, it's some people call it an educated guess, some people call it a shot in the dark. Okay? Yeah. The whole idea is to obviously try and get as much information as possible when you're first starting with that person. So in an ideal situation, I would know exactly how many calories this person maintains on, in which case you can kind of do a percentage-based formula where you just say, okay, let's take off 15% if they want a slow deficit, 20% if they want a moderate, and 25% if they want an aggressive one. That would be the like ideal. If I knew, like, okay, this person's on 2,500 calories maintaining, this is what we need to do, and then we adjust from there. But again, people react differently to different deficits. If it was someone that I literally had no idea of, I would typically take their body weight, find out what their general activity was, and use like a multiplier to work out their calories.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why I do it in pounds. I think it's just easier. But I would take someone's pounds and I would times it by 10 to 12 pounds. 12 pounds if they're active, 11 pounds if they're moderately active, and 10 pounds if they literally sit down all day.
Mm-hmm.
I'd typically rather start on the higher end and then bring things down. It just gives you more to work with. So, but again, it all depends on their situation in terms of how active they are typically. Well, I find that that's a good starting point for most people for fat loss. And then obviously maintenance is around 14 to 16 calories per pound, and then muscle gain usually 18 plus.
Got you.
But again, things vary so much. But, you know, when I analyse people's nutrition and their results, that is typically where everything falls, just to give you kind of a bit of a spectrum of, yep, how I would work out. And then I just adjust it weekly. You know, if they ain't losing, then I change things.
Yeah, basically. What's your opinion on the, I think the correct term is like metabolic damage. What, yeah. Not damage then. What's your opinion on essentially, take somebody who doesn't eat enough, right, for their weight, for example. And when I say enough, their diet might be shit, but they're just not eating frequently enough protein, etc. You're going to get a positive adaptation when you put that all back in, right? Now, yeah. Do you find that people underestimate sometimes, in contrast to overestimate what they can eat? Do they underestimate sometimes what they can also get away with? You know, they're under eating on a cut where you could say, God, you could probably be eating another 300 calories a day and still progress and feel better for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So I think what people, they look at calories in versus calories out, and they see them as being mutually exclusive when they actually work with each other. So the thing is what you'll find is that with some people, you'll drop their calories by 100, but then they'll end up dropping their activity by 150.
Okay, because they're too tired.
Yeah, because they're knackered, they start moving around less, they do less steps, they don't train as hard in the gym, and they just get a little bit lazy, subconsciously. A lot of the time it's subconscious, like they don't really realise it's happening.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that definitely the goal should be to lose weight on as many calories as possible, because that's going to give you more nutrition, more chance of holding on to muscle and things like that. So I think that's a big thing, is that the calories, what people don't realise is the calories in directly affects the calories out. And I'll take myself as an example as well. I could maintain on 2,500 calories, but I could also maintain on 2,800.
Yeah.
I'd be better maintaining on 2,800. And the reason why I maintain on 2,800 as well is because although I'm eating more food, subconsciously, I end up moving more. I train harder in the gym. And like you said about that training twice a day, like when you're training hard, you burn more calories.
Yeah.
So I definitely think that, you know, when people are saying that they're not eating enough, and they're not losing weight and they're eating really low calories, there's a couple of issues there. Either their bodies are getting lazy and they're just subconsciously getting lazy, or they're eating more calories than they think they are.
Yeah.
That is typically the way. So yeah, that's it really.
Got you. That makes sense. So that's actually quite interesting about the moving less when you cut your calories, because a lot of people don't think about that. They just think calories in, calories out. They don't think about what the rest of their life is, and they're still going to the gym 5 times a week, right? But they're not actually thinking what they're doing in the gym. You're quite big into tracking everything you do in the gym, right? Is that correct?
Yes.
So,
I track everything. But I think there's periods of time when you go through tracking and not tracking and stuff like that. Like, I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, just a bit of a nutter, like Rain Man or anything. I always say to people, and I think you'll agree with it as well, like, it's almost like your business. You kind of need to know what's coming in and going out at certain times. Like, there's definitely certain times where you can just coast it and you can just enjoy it, but sometimes when you really want to push for progress and kind of take it to the next level, you need to know what your incoming and outgoings are, where you should be investing and things like that. It's kind of the same with the gym.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, like, well, a good way to put it is I think everyone at different times, I'm at that stage for myself, you go, right, I'm going to step on it a bit more now. I've been doing fine, but now I want to do better. What's the first thing you start doing? You start assessing what you're doing, because then you need to quantify your progress. And so that's why I'm looking at now this week, where are my lifts at, what are my reps at for different things. And I don't track everything for every exercises. Like, I wouldn't track my strength on cable face pulls, for example. Personally, it'd be like my compound kind of builders. So if I've picked decline for chest, squats, etc., that's the thing I'm really trying to get strong on within certain rep ranges. That's how I would do it. How about yourself?
Yeah, I'm kind of similar. Like, I think that the more isolated the exercise gets, the less it kind of matters. Not to say that it doesn't matter, but for me personally, I'm not massively anal about it. I will track my big three, my squat, bench, and deadlift very closely, and I'll make sure that, you know, I'm programming them in all the time and making sure. Even to the point where I know exactly what I'm going to lift before I go in the gym.
Okay.
For those exercises. And then for the other exercises, you know, like, you've got your bent over rows, pull ups, like the kind of the big builders, I like to track them as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, the isolation stuff, you know, at the end of the session, I don't always track them, just based on the fact that it almost depends how the beginning of the session went.
Yeah.
Depends on how you feel. Like, if you hit a PR on a squat and then you're going to leg extension, your legs might be fried.
Yeah.
And making any sort of progression is just not going to happen. So, I tend to use that as the whole, like, mind muscle thing and really just kind of that burning out, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's a term.
Yeah. So with your training programming, again, for natural unassisted athletes, which I'd imagine most of them might be unless they're keeping secrets, is that you like to train most muscles twice a week or get to the crossover? Yeah.
Yeah, I like to train most muscles twice a week. Obviously, that's just based on the evidence and things like that. You know, two or three times a week. I think that I even just saw a picture the other day. You know, you look at, you know, and they may be on drugs, I don't know, but you look at cyclists.
Yeah.
They've got huge legs, and they might cycle every single day. So I'm not suggesting people train every single day and hit every muscle every single day, because it's just not realistic. You potentially joint issues and stuff like that. But I think that in order to get the volume to be able to grow muscle naturally as well, I think that, yeah, training muscles two, maybe three times a week for the smaller muscle groups is more beneficial, personally.
Mm.
And I think the science at the moment supports that as well. Obviously, that it may change, I don't know, but at the moment,
It's really interesting, because this is one I've done both of. I started out as like the old school bodybuilder split. At a young age, would even freak out the thought of doing a muscle more within a week, because I think something's going to happen. And then I've done the whole opposite. I've tried to train lagging muscle groups far more frequently, and I think it's definitely helped with certain muscle groups. Like, my shoulders definitely respond better to being trained more. But that just might be throwing six quick sets at the end of a back session on side raises, that kind of thing, just to re-stimulate. It's not a shoulder workout. But then there's other muscle groups where, so like my calves, again, I try and train three or four times a week because they're so stubborn. And then there's ones like my arms. I can train them once a week, once a month, three times a week, and they respond about the same, which is kind of interesting. But I don't know, I do think, it's just a theory, I guess, or a hunch, but I do think some muscles are the shoulders and calves, because of their role in your day-to-day life, are probably more, how can I say, they're more resilient in a way, because they've got to do a lot of kind of low-tempo work all the time, haven't they? So I don't know, it's quite interesting, isn't it, how you find some muscles respond differently to others.
Yeah, I think we'll find out more as well, like as new research comes out. But I think, you know, fiber type plays a role. But then, like you said, I think, you know, our shoulders get a work and calves get a workout just by sort of doing our daily tasks. I think it's different for different people. I think you've got to also think about overlap as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, like you said about your arms, you might actually be hitting them a little bit, obviously, when you're doing back work and things like that, and your chest work. So you may not need to train them as frequently. And I think as well that you obviously see these guys that train a muscle group once a week and see great results. And, you know, they've been training for 10 years and they look phenomenal. I think training more frequently just allows you to get there a bit quicker.
Yeah.
But I think that you eventually get there.
Yeah, yeah.
Like everyone gets it. If you train for long enough, everyone gets there. Because there's always that big dude in the gym that's like, oh, I only train everything once a week. It's like, yeah, I think you can build muscle. I just think more frequently, especially to start with, you can, you just build it a bit quicker. I think once a week training still works. It's not what I'd recommend. But if you're willing to be patient, I think you'll still get there.
Yeah. I think as well, it's about what you feel, what you enjoy doing as well. I think I never really thought about this, but as I've tried more training routines, there's some I've generally not particularly enjoyed, just hasn't stimulated my mind as such. I'll do them. But I think there's a big thing about enjoying what you're doing in the gym, you know, because it's a bit like that. If you enjoy it, you'll do it. And it's quite interesting. Like I enjoyed doing strength training for a period of time. It really excited me, so I got good at it. But it was only because I wanted to do it. As if I hated it, I wouldn't have done it, right? Yeah. That's why I was so crap for years before strength training, so I never did it because I didn't enjoy it. Then I kind of found joy through it. So no, it's quite interesting how like your training can kind of change in that respect. Do you do much in terms of rep range variation, or are you very much like 8 to 12 rep range for hypertrophy per se?
You probably know what I'm going to say. So again, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's stuff that you want to enjoy, and none of my clients' programs are the same, because I think we know now. A lot of my clients, they're looking just to build lean muscle. There's a few that are going for powerlifting competitions, and obviously, if you're going for a powerlifting competition, you need to get more specific. The closer the competition comes, you need to start doing low rep stuff, because you need to start increasing your 1RM. You need to practice, because a load at your 3 rep max feels completely different to your 10 rep max.
Yeah.
Although they're both maxes, it feels different, the technique is different, and things like that. So I think if someone has a really specific goal, then I will obviously push them towards that direction, because they need to do it. But other than that, I think that pretty much anywhere from the 6th to even up to 20 rep range, it becomes what rep range is going to allow you to put the most effort in.
Mm.
That's going to give you the greatest hypertrophy. Not 6 to 10 versus 15 to 20. Which one is going to make you work harder?
Mm-hmm.
That is going to give you the greatest results. Because I think, but typically for most people's programs, I have a mixture of everything. And it is typically the more kind of compound movements like the rows and the presses and stuff, that will be anywhere from a 6 to 12 rep range, and then isolations will be anywhere from 10 to 20.
Got you. That makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. And you've made a transition to powerlifting a little bit later in your lifting career, haven't you, so to speak?
Yeah.
How do you find that affect hypertrophy in terms, when I say hypertrophy, I mean sarcoplasmic hypertrophy, so size in normal guys talk. How do you find that has affected it? Better, worse, or is it harder to manage? Do you find your joints get more sore because of it? That kind of thing.
Definitely found that I picked up little nibbles.
Okay.
But I think that I encourage people to do both based on the fact that I think you can unlock potential. But I found that my legs were lacking pretty bad. And then I got into powerlifting, and by getting stronger, it allows you to, over time, accrue more volume.
Mm.
So you're lifting more weight for more reps, and you're basically pushing more volume through your legs, essentially. And it doesn't always run true, but my argument is always, you don't see people that can squat 180, like yourself, with small legs. Do you see what I mean? Like, I think there is definitely a component of strength leading to hypertrophy and hypertrophy leading to strength. So I think it's good to try and get stronger and try and incorporate both and increasing volume. But yeah, I would just say that the hardest thing with doing the lower rep ranges and more powerlifting stuff is to be able to get the same sort of hypertrophy, you need to do more sets.
Yeah, because... yeah.
For the volume. So basically there's a study by Brad Schoenfeld, and he compared, I think it was exactly the same volume, and it was 3 sets of 10 versus 7 sets of 3.
Mm-hmm.
And the volume load is the same. So let's say they both lifted 2,000 kilos. So it's exactly the same, but obviously completely different in terms of how much they were lifting. And while the hypertrophy was exactly the same, the guys doing 7x3 took 3 times longer, and they got more more injuries and stuff like that. So it's kind of like powerlifting, you can get hypertrophy from powerlifting, but it's a higher risk. It's more difficult to get the volume in. So that's kind of why I like to incorporate both. Like, for a lot of my clients, you know, the bigger lifts, I will do lower reps. But I think to be able to get a decent amount of volume for hypertrophy, you need to include higher reps.
Yeah, I think...
it makes it easier.
Yeah, exactly. I think as well, technique's a big thing, because I think the heavier you go or closer to your max, I think the better you need to be.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
Like, I think most people's hip mobility, just basic stuff, is just not right to be doing super heavy deadlifts and stuff. So it's just basic stuff like that, which I found myself, yeah, I've had my fair share of injuries from, and when I did like my strength phase, where I still do, you know, I'll go heavy, but like I definitely found my body was more susceptible to achy joints and, you know, but a part of it was potentially, I don't know if overtraining the right word, but I was just training so frequently, it was like my body just didn't have a time to recover, I don't think. It was connective tissues mainly. But it definitely helped me get bigger, because it was amazing. Just 2 years ago when I lived in Surrey, I was struggling to shoulder press 40 kilo dumbbells, and now I'll do those between 20 and 30 reps. But that's only because I've got stronger. There's no way I've got that much stronger in that much time. I think it was a case of unlocking a new, like you said, new level of potential by factoring in, I don't know, well, just getting stronger really with that specific training. So it definitely does help.
Yeah, I think it improves the technique at lower reps, because like you say, you'll basically go through a phase of, let's say you're squatting 120 kilos for 8 reps or whatever, and then you go through a strength block and you're lifting 160 kilos. When you go back to lifting the 8 reps again, you finally can do 140.
Yeah.
Like, so it's kind of like, you're just kind of going up and down, but eventually, like, everything is kind of going up linearly.
Yeah, and that's what I found, is that it's not just the strength in the low reps, it's the getting stronger. By getting strong in the low reps, you can get a lot stronger in the higher reps as well.
Which transfers. So that's kind of what I found. I found that I went, again, I kind of swung the pendulum too far. I went like pure bodybuilding over to kind of pure powerlifting, and now I'm finding, as with most things in fitness, like the answer is somewhere in between. Yeah. So I'm doing a lot of low volume work, but then I follow that up with high volume, you know, reps in the kind of anywhere from 8 to 20 rep range on some other stuff, because I want to be strong, but I also want to look good. So
I think
they complement each other really well.
Yeah, I agree. I think for me, I'm in a similar position, and I've got the Man for Life columnist Rob Coles, who handles like injury stuff, specifically movement patterns. He's doing my programming for that reason, because I know I can get strong and like my lifts are big, but what I need to do is be able to avoid injury. That's my weakness. So to me, there's clearly an issue in some of my movement patterns. So it's like, we want to get all of that whilst staying fit. So that's why he's doing it, and that's where his strength comes in. So I'm excited to see if I can get strong and stay strong whilst not having like a bad hip or like a bad low back or shoulder pain. Because I think a lot of guys get that, and I do believe a lot of it's avoidable. You do get wear and tear from training, but I do think a lot of it's avoidable from, like I'm terrible. I'm so lazy with stuff. Like, I think you're much better than me at like mobility stuff and foam rolling. I get bored. I'm like a child. 2 minutes and I'm done. But I think, again, it's an age thing. It's like, right, you need to fix this. So I think just by doing that kind of thing, a daily habit helps a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I like to like factor in mobility, but again, sometimes I skip it, and it's not until you kind of get a nibble or an injury and you're like, okay, I shouldn't have skipped it. And you do kind of get a reminder every now and then that you should keep up with it. But fortunately, I do attribute my kind of lack of injuries to both sensible programming and being aware of those movement patterns and things like that. Like, I had a little nibble in my wrist just recently, and again, just working on mobility, understanding where my weaknesses were, which is on my left side. You know, you can kind of, yeah, just work around them, really. I think it's just about being sensible, not, you know, knowing when to pull back, basically. But I agree with you that a lot of these can be avoided.
Yeah, so to wrap up, what's your, very briefly, you have no loyalty to a supplement brand, as far as I'm aware. So what's your take on supplements? And the reason I ask is, it's a bit of an open-ended question, but our audience obviously uses a lot of supplements. I use supplements, but I use them for very different reasons to when I was 20 or 21.
Yeah.
I don't go for the most fluorescent pink shock formula I can find, because I think it's going to be more hardcore. So what's your take on it?
So the reason I'm not associated with a supplement company, and I have been approached several times, the reason I don't is because I love variety. Like, I always don't want to be associated to a supplement brand that only does one supplement or like one flavour or whatever. Like, I just like trying stuff. So,
yeah.
I like supplements. I think the key is in the name, it's a supplement, and I think that you just really need to do your research. There's a great, great resource, examine.com, which you may know of. It's an awesome resource for supplements. And I think it's just about understanding what the supplement does and knowing the correct dosages and looking out for the correct stuff. So, pre-workouts and stuff, like, a lot of them are good, but some of them don't have the correct dosages in. And I think there's a lot of supplements that are sold on poor science.
Yeah.
So, for example, there'll be some supplements that are sold because they worked in one study with overweight females and they lost 0.1 kilos more in 2 weeks. Yeah. Or something like, do you see what I mean? Like, yeah, real kind of distorted science. Yeah. And they will sell a supplement saying ultimate fat burner. And it'd be like, is it really? Like, let's look at it properly. Does this relate to resistance-trained males or females that have been training for years? They're already lean. Like, you've got to understand and you've got to know these things, because a lot of these supplements, like, they're not necessarily lying.
Yeah, it's just
economical. But they're just cherry-picking data, really. So, supplements, there's probably a handful that are useful compared to the 100 that are out there.
What supplements would you say are essential for guys? I suppose you can go beyond that and say, in an ideal world, if someone has an open budget, but just go for essentials. What would a guy be using?
Okay, so if you consider whey protein a supplement to supplement protein, obviously it's kind of technically a food, but it's kind of a protein supplement sold in supplement shops. So definitely a whey protein, I think that's good. There is a little bit of research to suggest, again, that casein before bed, although we thought it didn't, apparently that is. So, but I definitely wouldn't consider that essential. A multivitamin, low-dose multivitamin, again, just to kind of cover the bases for me, doesn't need to be expensive. Creatine monohydrate, that's, again, a very well-researched supplement. Omega-3s and vitamin D3 in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
That would probably be, citrulline malate, there's more research. But again, these are kind of like, your last 5%, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'd rather, if this is going to cost you 50 quid a month, you might even be better just spending that on food. But those would be like the ones that currently have the most research behind them. That's what I recommend to my clients anyway. I say, these are what I recommend. They're not essential. These are the results you maybe I expect from it. These are what I recommend, but it's up to you.
Awesome. That makes sense. So how can people, where can people follow you and contact you if they want to be coached by you?
Okay, so my website, so everything is my name, basically, which helps. So just help. At Harry Ranson, that is on Instagram, Twitter, which I rarely use, and Facebook, Harry Ranson, and then obviously my website, www.harryranson.com, that has my recipes and stuff on there, also like all my coaching packages and things like that.
Amazing. That's so cool.
And YouTube as well, Harry Ranson on YouTube.
Have you started doing more on YouTube?
Yeah, I've been doing more. That's how I've been doing, like, working with muscle food and stuff like that. I hope to be doing more of that throughout the year as well. So
cool. Okay, I really appreciate you coming.